now Kevin and Pam's kids know that at least one of them was conceived in the front seat of a truck.
Yeah. Oh, that's brilliant.
Welcome to Vassals of King's Grave. I'm Julia. My old form name was No True Lady, and I'm also here with Bina 007. And we're doing a movie vlog today about the very well-reviewed, but not very well-rewarded, awarded movie, The Iron Claw, right?
Yeah, this is a totally hidden gem, apparently. I only knew about it because it was already out in the UK. It hadn't crossed my path. And you were telling me, oh my God, this film is so amazing. I can't wait to talk about it with you. So I sought it out and it blew my mind. I mean, I spoke a lot on our last movie podcast about how Poor Things, Oppenheimer, Zone of Interest were in this like auteur category for me last year. And then films like Anatomy of a Fall kind of coming very close underneath that and Past Lives. And this is in there. I mean, this is a phenomenal film. Why are people not talking about this more? Why are they not going to see it more? Why did the studio A24, which has a great reputation in independent film, why did it not put this film in the festival circuit? Why is Zac Efron not being nominated for Oscars? I don't understand.
I decided to put all the eggs into the basket of Poor Things so Bella could eat them raw and make some sort of pithy comment about it. It is a bit of a mystery. I don't know if it's just because of these sort of film culture circles that I run in online that I knew about this movie before it came out and was excited for it. And I do see people talking about it, but maybe it's because of my self-selected media culture community.
Yeah, but do you think there is something to the idea that with smaller films like this, like from A24, which is a smaller distributor, that there isn't the money to support everything? So they have to be selective on what they're going to put forward. And because it shocked me that this just had a cold open in Dallas. I mean, it didn't even play Toronto or it didn't play any festivals.
Really?
And the guy who wrote it and directed it, Sean Durkin, has track record. His first film, Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, was like the critical darling at Sundance and went on to make a bunch of money. You know, it's not like he doesn't have track record. And I'm just really surprised this was just sort of left to dribble out in December in peak awards season and just feels like it was left and abandoned. And I was thinking a lot watching this about the incredibly critically acclaimed film The Wrestler and the way that came out. So that was a Darren Aronofsky film and that played all the festivals. It won the Golden Lion at Venice. And then I think Mickey Rourke ended up being nominated for an Oscar. And I just felt like, why wouldn't this film have been given that run, like Venice, Toronto, London, into awards season? But hopefully this podcast will be more to watch it, though, at least.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely know people, like I said, that sort of groups of people who are interested in such things, who find each other online as we do. They've been talking about it. I sort of took for granted that it was going to do that kind of festival run just because, you know, because it is A24 and also just the nature of the film. I sort of just take those things for granted. But I mean, in all possibility, they decided, to put all that budget behind Poor Things, which, as we all agreed previously, is incredible and amazing, and we all love it. And I mean, I'm really baffled as to why Zac Efron didn't get any nominations for the Golden Globes or the Oscars, because I mean, he was incredible in this. He made me forget that the real Kevin Von Erich is a tall, lanky, blonde guy.
So I have to ask you, did you know the story of the Von Erich family before you watched the film?
Vaguely. Professional wrestling, I mean, definitely it's part of the whole, you know, American stew, if you will. It's out there. And again, just sort of the interest groups that I run in, you do find people who are really into it. You know, I remember when I lived in California, a friend hosted a watch party for WrestleMania. And, you know, I've passively watched professional wrestling, you know, when I was younger as a kid, if it's on TV, you watch it and be like, oh, what's this? I just, that one experience, learning that it was a lot more of a layered, complex thing.
It's so weird. And I feel that in England, wrestling, well, maybe it is a big thing and it's just not something that is big for me. The only time I've ever engaged with wrestling is kind of meta wrestling. So wrestling on film. So The Wrestler, obviously, the aforementioned film, and then TV shows like Glamorous Ladies of Wrestling, like GLOW. But I've never watched a wrestling match.
I've never seen one live. I've only watched them on TV. And again, then only sort of half interested. It is a topic that is very ripe for cinematic creative exploration, because you have this, you know, full spectrum of human drama. And then you have a real athleticism with a lot of mixed in that are very potent. You know, there is people really trying to succeed in their career. There's injuries. There's severe brain injuries. There's a lot of tragedy of wrestlers who die young, which is basically what this movie is about. You know,
is because it worth saying to the listener that we're going to spoil the story of the film, of the Von Erich family?
Yeah, we're going to tell the whole story and then some, because, you know, for the sake of streamlining to tell a story within a film, they did leave out quite a bit.
Yeah. So we are going to get into the story of this family. It is tragic. And if any of you listening have particular triggers around suicide, this is probably the time to turn off. Sadly, that is going to be a bit of a theme here.
Yes. And disordered eating and emotional abuse and toxic. Well, I mean, it is a really good thing, a really, really good story about the effects of true toxic masculinity, true patriarchal culture, and escaping it.
Yeah, and it's kind of weird to me. I was reading a lot of the reviews, and many are glowing, but some are critical, and they say, oh, but it's just so depressing, and it's a dirge. And I actually feel that when you go into that final act, it emerges hopeful, but maybe we can get into it as we go through the film. I had no idea who this family was. I didn't even know it was a real family until the opening kind of title card that says this is based on a real story. So when we get to the second half of the film and the brothers just start dying, I was just in shock. And even today, I just rewatched it before this. I feel so emotionally affected. And viewers, if you haven't seen this film, you should switch off this podcast, but just know that this is such a beautifully recreated, emotional, rich, layered, gorgeous film about something we don't often see about film, which is brothers who love each other and, just dealing with toxic masculinity, dealing with overbearing parents, living up to your parents' expectation. It's so relatable. But just seeing brothers on screen, that kind of shot, that dream sequence shot, it's so beautiful. And it just moved me deeply when that little kid out of the mouths of Babe said, oh, what are you talking about, Dad? Of course, we cry all the time. What's making you sad? That's okay, Dad. We'll be your brothers. I mean, this film just absolutely broke my heart, but rebuilt it mended it and sent me off feeling bittersweet and hopeful. So please go watch this film.
It's an emotional release is what I've heard it described as. You know, the idea of wrestling dynasties within the professional wrestling world is a very common thing. There are there are plenty of families like this who this is what they do. And we'll get into what became of some of the kids, but it's not an uncommon thing. Yeah, I think also in professional athletics, it's not an uncommon thing in general, but, you know, definitely it's something you see in pro wrestling. So, did you want to start us off? It's, I believe it's 1978 or 79 right now.
So we start with a little flashback. So basically, maybe a way to do it is to do it through the brothers in order, but start with the parents and that'll take us through the plot in a way. Mm-hmm. So the paterfamilias is Fritz Holt, is Fritz, the dad, Fritz von Erich, who has renamed himself. He's actually Jack Atkinson, right? And he's renamed himself to make a kind of avatar for wrestling, which is Nazi, which is white.
In the wrestling world, it's referred to as a heel. You know, you're basically positioning yourself as the villain character.
The bad guy, right.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
And he's played by Holt McElhenney, who it was really bugging me, who he reminded me of. I suddenly realized he was the main guy from Mindhunter, so if any of you were into that TV series. But he's basically set up in this kind of black and white flashback to be this thwarted man who thinks that the Wrestling Federation has robbed him of his chance at a world title and therefore is seeking revenge through his many sons, who he basically coerces into becoming wrestlers and competing for the belt, whether or not they show any particular affinity or desire to be wrestlers. And he, like, there's an early scene where he openly says at the breakfast table, he kind of lists his sons in order of preference. You know, this whole thing, like, you never pick between your children. You love them all equally. He just openly says, right, the current order is this. But remember, the order can change. So if you strive to please me, the order can change. And that just sets up the film and these poor kids who feel trapped trying to please him and claustrophobic in his ambition. And yeah, like you say, like the kind of, I guess, the arc is the eldest son, Kevin, trying to break away. But he does have this wife, right? This wife, Doris, played by Maura Tierney, who fans love will her. Remember. And yeah, love her, and fans of The Affair, the TV show. And she doesn't get much really to do. She's sort of this highly religious woman who, I guess, is swallowing a lot of her emotions. She has one scene near the end where she gets to express them, but really she's very in the background. It's like this entire massive family is just at service of Fritz. Do you want to talk about them? I mean, I don't know. Is that typical for like a wrestling paterfamilias? I don't know, but horrible.
I don't know too much about the inner workings of wrestling families, except for this one, because I've researched it. But I mean, I think that, you know, when you have this sort of like, you know, highly driven sort of family unit, you know, there has to be one really dominant parent and the other who's sort of more the supporting role. You know, Doris is there basically feeding them. And one thing that I do like that the movie gets right is the sheer amount of food that you have to eat to maintain this level of athleticism and physical activity and exercising and muscle building. That is accurate. I have seen it in people I know who you know train or you know did professional bodybuilding. So. That was a nice little nod to the reality of it. Just like, here's your dozen eggs for breakfast, and that's just for one person.
And it's a feature of Sean Deakin's movies, isn't it? He makes them very realistic. I think this movie, the way they recreate the late 70s and early 80s through music and costume and set, so real and lived in and almost warm and welcoming. Like, it's a world and beautiful. Yeah, served. And that's what he does. Like, and apparently for people who know wrestling, including the real life Kevin, who turned up at the premiere, apparently the choreography of the wrestling scenes is absolutely impeccable.
So, oh, well, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah.
And let's comment on Zac Efron's body. Let's comment on maybe not Harris Dickinson's, but Jeremy Allen White. He looks like a wrestler, right? I mean, he's got the physique.
So. Yeah. I mean, part of it too is in order to see all those muscles popping out like that, to see that definition, that's not normal. The way the other brothers look is much more normal, that like it's there, but it's sort of covered by, you know, hydrated skin, hydrated bodies, fat. And in order to get that definition for competition, for photo shoots, for a role, you have to do, and this is regardless of male or female, it's a process called cutting, where you severely cut down your diet and also purposely dehydrate yourself. That's the only way to get that definition. And it's a miserable thing to do. You can't really do it for long periods of time, but it is not the normal way that bodies look. Even when you were at that level of musculature and fitness. So
it is amazing though, because that first shot of Zac Efron where the camera really interrogates his body like he's a thing. Mm-hmm. It's very similar to how Mickey Rourke is shot in The Wrestler. And it really is. I mean, it's less extreme for the rest of the movie, but they're making a point
about a person who's almost like mutilated their body for this thing, for this dream that maybe isn't even his dream, you know? It's amazing.
Yeah.
Is there anything redeeming about the dad? And should the mum have intervened? I don't know.
So here was my take on the parents. They weren't bad, but they were wrong.
Yeah.
They were wrong.
That's a good way of putting it.
And that's what this very, you know, high demand, high achieving, and extremely, you know, traditionally patriarchal sort of, you know, cultural configuration, family configuration leads to, period. And I feel like a point, because like we start with the flashback of the boys being young and they're living in a camper that they drive around in their car going from wrestling match to wrestling match. You got the two little boys in the back seat. Mom's pregnant with the next one. And, you know, and the dad's talking about how they're going to be more successful. He's already, you know, bought this new car that's waiting for them. And the wife's like, with what money? You know, a very typical sort of conversation that you would see in that kind of a situation. And then we flash forward, you know, roughly, you know, like 20-ish years, and you do see that they have done well for themselves. And they have this beautiful farm that, you know, they've established themselves. They are doing well. And one thing that you feel throughout the film is that if the boys had just been left, I mean, like, yes, obviously they need, you know, you need structure, you need, you know, parents to help you figure out what you want to do. But if they had been less controlling, then the boys would have all been able to, you know, grow up past the age of 22 and be successful in their own ways.
It's so funny, isn't it? Because we're referring to them as boys, and it's so interesting how Fritz always refers to them as boys, even when they're in manhood. Like, they're just so infantilized. They're so controlled. They can't be men, right? They can't move out.
Exactly. And that was an interesting choice in the movie, because the thing is, two of the brothers were also married. Like, we're presented in the movie, it was as like Kevin being the only one who, you know, starts a family. But the fact is that, you know, Terry was married and had two children. And the first one who dies, David, he was also briefly married and did have a child who tragically died young. But I mean, like, it's not like he was the only one. But again, storytelling choices, streamlining the story, you know, to focus on Kevin as the only one who, quote unquote, made it out.
Let's start getting into the family then. So when we meet them in 1979, we are already aware through Kevin that he's not actually the elder brother, even though we think he is. There was an elder brother who died very young called Jack Adkinson Jr. Apparently he died at the age of 6 in Niagara Falls. He stepped on a trailer tongue, was electrically shocked, and then fell into a melting snow puddle face first and drowned. I mean, I mean, that's just horrific.
Yeah, it is a true freak accident, but it's sort of the origin point of this legend of the curse on the family
which Kevin legitimately believes in, apparently, right? He thinks they're cursed.
I'm not sure. I mean, I think very much at one point, you know, I mean, there's a hard way not to believe it with everything that happens, but Jack Jr. dying like that was the beginning of that. And also some thoughts of like taking the mother's maiden name Von Erich, like maybe there was something associated with her side of the family, I think was sort of alluded to, you know, like bringing something onto them that wouldn't have been there otherwise.
It's fascinating. And I feel that, I don't know, when the movie opens for real in 1979, it is told through Kevin, who's kind of the elder brother, or the elder surviving brother, played by Zac Efron. Mm-hmm. I mean, we could do a whole podcast on Zac Efron, right? This like gorgeous young teen in High School Musical, and then, you know, playing Ted Bundy with such acclaim. Mm-hmm. He's gone through so much in his personal life with mental health issues, addiction issues. He emerges sober, buff. He's done stuff to his face, though, hasn't he? I mean, there's so many analogies to the actual making of the wrestler and Mickey Rourke going from teen idol to sort of, you know, person who has in some ways created a face that is not quite his own. And then he shows up as Kevin, and he's just heartbreaking, right? He's just such a lovely guy. He takes on the mantle of being Big Brother. He is caring towards the other brothers, even though they're in competition, even though he sees the one brother, one younger than him, David, who is surpassing him in his father's affections, because poor Kevin, though probably the best of the fighters, is he's not articulate. So he this was really helpful for people like me. He has a meet cute first date with Pam, played by Lily James, who will go on to marry. And she says, but it's all staged, isn't it? And he's like, yeah, but no, but because yes, the fights are staged, but you still have to go through the pain. You still got to do the fights. And then also it's all about the character and who the audience is root for. And that's what determines success. So the fact that he's good in the ring, but can't articulate himself out of the ring in the press conferences is kind of tragic. And then you've got David, who is kind of more of a natural showman, and he kind of takes over in his dad's affections. And I thought that was heartbreaking. But how did you, I mean, this is how you open it to me on Instagram Messenger. You were like, you have to see The Iron Claw. This is Zac Efron's career best performance. Why is he not getting an Oscar? So you tell me about Kevin.
Well, so one thing I do want to just sort of bring up when we do flash forward to when the sons are adults is, you know, we do see this shot, these establishing shots of their farm, the beautiful, you know, nature of Texas, which is definitely a thread through the story. And we see their house, and we get a classic Chekhov's gun moment, don't we? We get a shot at a display case that has some guns in it, which, first of all, that, I mean, like, I think that might be more of a relic of past years, because now with, you know, in the past decades of the pushes for gun safety, you keep those in a gun safe, not, you don't display them unless it's something that can't be fired, you know, it's... So you see that, you see these various totems of Americana, the family photos with the young son tucked in the corner, the one who died, and, you know, very much like, again, the creation of this setting, like it definitely feels familiar to me. Like these were the way the kitchens looked like early and mid 80s, because everything had been renovated in the 70s with these new looks, and we're still around, you know, what's like, you know, the decade minus later. So it's, you know, very like, yeah, it was a very warm, like, oh, I know where we are. But so we get Kevin, and Kevin's arc is really interesting, because as you already said, he is the one trying so hard and really putting himself through hell physically. And it's just not getting him anywhere with his dad, because despite the victories and the achievements and progress he does make, suddenly his dad will like inexplicably turn around and be like, and that's why David's going to be the next one. Or, yeah. You know, and I mean, yeah, it is a big reason that David is able to do the stage presence. Because, I mean, yeah, the pro wrestling, it is a performance. You know, it is that mix of athleticism and performance, the way, say, ballet is, or, you know, being a Broadway actor, you know, having to sing and dance and act. It's very similar to that. And if you can't get that sort of chatter part locked down, which is a huge part of it, you're not going to go anywhere. So, yeah. I mean, very quickly, despite the constant training and the constant effort, the dad just sort of keeps picking up on the other brothers one by one and pushing them to the forefront. And I feel like we never really got a good reason about why the dad was not interested in Kevin, other than Kevin not being able to do that sort of...
I think that was enough. I think the dad was just incredibly ruthless. Actually what is a factually correct decision that Kevin will not be world champion, because he is crap at the publicity stuff. I mean, we're shown a scene where he's tortuous in front of a mic. And I think the dad is kind of like just ruthlessly, coldly efficient. Not you, on to the next. And then not you, on to the next. I mean, I think there's total logic in what the dad does. It's just absolutely brutal. And what's amazing is, I mean, it bubbles up a little bit more between Kevin and Carrie, but, you know, actually between Kevin and David, it's not like they still love each other, these brothers. What's amazing is that the dad doesn't turn the brothers really against each other.
Part of the structure of the family is one of the ways that both the parents keep control over the boys is that, and the mom straight up says it, you know, like that at one point Kevin goes to try to talk to her and she's like, honey, that's what your brothers are for. And just completely shuts him down.
Don't look to us for emotional support. Go talk to your brain.
Exactly. It's each other. And they create this interdependence among the brothers, and then really create this hierarchy with the parents being managers versus parents.
The original momages and dadages. Maybe yes. We'll go to the next brothers and come back to Kevin at the end, because he does kind of bookend this piece. Yeah. So we then
I just wanted to mention that Kevin, you know, as he continues facing, you know, his dad not pushing him forward in any way, despite all of his genuine efforts, he sort of starts to go off and live his own life. He meets this young woman, Pam, after a match, and Pam is fantastic, played by Lily James. She just immediately, she knows what she wants. She gets in there and she immediately offers him an alternative to that toxic masculinity, patriarchal world. It's like, hey, you know, it's almost 1980. The world's changing. I want to be a veterinarian with my own practice. I also want to have kids. What do you think about that?
It's so cute. And he says, yeah, mm-hmm. I guess we'll be one of those modern marriages. And you're
yes,
just like,
exactly.
Kevin, from all of your life experience, where do you even know what a working woman in a modern marriage looks like? I mean, bless you for like having that magnanimity. It's just so gorgeous. I totally believed in this relationship. And uh-huh. I think Lily James is an interesting actress. And I think certainly in England, she's tarnished her image a little bit. But
really,
I feel that she's taking on fat. She always used to play these simpering roles. And the epitome of that was the Cinderella live action remake.
Oh, yeah.
Fairy tale little girls. But she's chosen some fascinating roles in America recently. She played Pamela Anderson and Pam and Tommy, and I think she did an amazing job in that.
Right, yeah.
And I think this is another really fun, interesting role because it's nuanced. She could easily have just been pitted against the mum and dad because she's, mm-hmm. you know, trying to get her husband away from them. But actually, she has a lot of fun with the family and she mm-hmm. supports the mum in her mourning. But at the end of the day, she anchors Kevin. She gives him children, a family, an alternative center of gravity. And I think she saves him, really. And it's a mm-hmm. really credible performance. It's a lovely, lovely depiction of a really good supportive marriage. And I just find Lily James is doing some interesting work, like quietly going about doing some interesting work and making some interesting choices right now.
No, I mean, like I really enjoyed her. You know, someone that I think both of us as modern, you know, women can link up with and be like, well, yeah, of course that's how it's going to be. But it was still quite something back, you know, 40 some odd years ago.
I think those of us who think that now, we stand on, because she's our mom's generation, basically. And we stand on the shoulders of that generation who had to have those conversations and say, I want to live my life this way. Are you going to support me in that? Or is that going to be a problem? And I thank them for their service.
Mm-hmm. And the real Kevin and Pam are still together to this day.
I love
thriving.
It.
They live in Hawaii. They have like a farm out there. I mean, like they're doing. They made it. They think that they have four kids. We'll get to their kids later. But you know, so she is welcomed into the family. The dad, you know, gives his seal of approval, saying to Kevin, "Hold on to that one." But it is nice to see that it isn't that classic pitting her against the family. And family is the big theme of the movie. So we get to see function versus dysfunction. And then, you know, I feel like with Pam in there, you see the potential of what the Von Erich family could have been, you know,
yes.
or that there is this closeness.
And becomes
there is,
in the next generation.
Yes.
A healthier version, yes. right, in the next generation.
Exactly. Exactly. You see that for sure. So they start their relationship. They get married and have, you know, a quote unquote shotgun wedding because she's already pregnant. And like, this is also when we sort of see the peak, the happy times, the good times of, you know, they're going to parties and, the younger brother, Mike, who's this very sort of like gentle poetic soul. He wants to be a musician. You know, we see him playing around with that.
Should we do David next? Cause he's the sort of next youngest, isn't
yes.
he? He emerges
yes, exactly.
as the rival
yeah.
before Carrie. So he's played by Harris Dickinson, who's a British actor, actually. And
really?
He's done a number of really fun films, including Triangle of Sadness that won the Palme d'Or.
Oh, yes.
And he was fantastic in that, playing a model, very satirical, black, dark film. I would highly recommend Triangle of Sadness to anyone who wants something so scabrous at bites. I didn't realize it was him at first because he, the hair, the sort of the wigs they all wear are just so hilarious. Mm-hmm. He is a natural showman. He doesn't have the physique of Zac Efron. So if you were to criticize, maybe he doesn't quite look like a wrestler. Maybe he needed to put on a bit more muscle. Yeah, but he is a natural showman. The dad picks him to go to contest a fight in Japan because you've got to get the world belt that the dad thinks he's been denied. You've got to go win in Japan. He shows up to the Kevin's wedding and, you know, that wedding scene is so beautiful. It's just so well done. So much going on there. But it's clear that he's not well. He's like, he's vomiting into the toilet bowl.
Vomiting blood.
Kevin says, you know, you really shouldn't go. And they both just start laughing because they know it's not an option. And then cut to the dad getting a phone call saying your son died of enteritis when he was out in Japan. Which the film seems to take at face value. This is what Ric Flair, who is a big character in the film, actually, like an antagonist to the family.
Yeah, he's depicted.
He wrote in his biography, to be the man. I mean, is there anything more toxic masculinity than that title? That, quote, everyone in wrestling believes that it was a drug overdose that really killed him. And that Bruiser Brody, a fellow wrestler who found David, disposed of the narcotics by flushing them down a toilet before the police arrived. Mick Foley, whoever he is, also claims that David died from an apparent drug overdose, which they don't really do. I think in the film, it's just depicted as straight ahead, kind of like the curse of the Von Erichs, that he was just really sick, shouldn't have fought and died.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is a theory. Mick Foley is another wrestler. He's definitely like sort of an elder statesman of wrestling at this point. He's very well respected. Like he's like good friends with the musician Tori Amos, for example. He's a real bit of a renaissance man. But yeah, I had read that too, that there was that dispute. I think the official story was that he died of some sort of internal bleeding. And, you know, yes, it could have been, that he had ruptured intestines. So that's what the family says. And this is the official cause of death that the doctors in Japan who examined him determined.
Film is respectful of that. Like, there's no hint that there's anything else going on. So
But, I mean, again, it's one of those choices of, I mean, like, you know, I feel like there was a lot of deference to the Von Erich family, to Kevin especially, which is fine. That's fine, you know, and they're just trying to tell. I mean, there's a lot of story here, so you have to make those choices. But the wedding is sort of that last moment of pure happiness, you know, of you're reveling in youth and, you know, starting off on your adult life, and then things really take a turn. Yeah,
absolutely. So you get the death of David, and it's kind of halfway through film, and then it just seems to be relentless. So David dies abroad, off screen, and then so therefore you think then that maybe the dad would once again turn to Kevin, but no, he turns to Kerry, the next brother, who's played by Jeremy Allen White, who everyone now knows from The Bear, the amazing TV show, which is, by the way, not a comedy, and I guess from Jeremy Allen White's Calvin Klein commercials, where he obviously got ripped for this film and then used it to great advantage. When the film opens in 79, he's actually not wrestling but training to do the discus at the Olympics, but then the US boycotted the 1980 Olympics for Cold War reasons. Mm-hmm. So at that point he's at a loose end, so he goes back into wrestling. Now I'm curious to hear your interpretation of this. This is in the wake of David having died, the pressure from the father, which Kerry, a bit like Kevin, seems to really want to pander to the father and compete for his attention. So I feel there's almost more tension between Kerry and Kevin than between Kevin and David. But he goes on a motorbike ride, and the way it's shot, it's him looking straight ahead, and then it just cuts to black. I mean, this is very much Sean Durkin and his Martha Marcy May Marlene mode. And then there's a scene which is so cleverly done where you see him sort of waking up, crushing pills, his back is bruised, he's got crushes. But I mean, it plays it for a while, and it's only when he rounds the corner into the kitchen that you realize that he's lost his foot in this accident. And I want to ask you, especially in light of what happens later, do you feel when he was riding that motorbike that he wanted to crash and commit suicide then?
Well, I mean, you know, you can want to die without really wanting to die. There's, you know, you can engage in high risk behaviors, you know, and have that passive sort of feeling because of stress. So I think that was entirely possible.
He loses his foot. He obviously is in a lot of pain. He wants to train. It's very frustrating. Mm-hmm. Shades of Jamie Lannister hair.
Oh,
I mean,
very
to
much.
Me, it's insane that you would wear a fake foot and try and train to. I mean, the whole concept to me is just insane. He's obviously deeply frustrated, deeply angry with himself, with the world. He gifts his father a very pretty gun for. And the dad doesn't use it immediately, which is annoying to him. He calls his brother Kevin, clearly suicidal, but doesn't tell him where he is. And then we learn that he has committed suicide with that gun. So it's a very, very tragic end. He's a very sort of, I think we've come to know Jeremy Allen White as this very melancholy, soulful actor when he wants to be. And all of that is injected into Kerry. And it's heartbreaking. And poor Kevin, two brothers gone in very short order. Yeah, I mean, so that was my question on him, really, is like, because we don't really see the family in this, we don't see that he's married, but how far was this the foot going? How far was this inevitable? Yeah,
well,
thoughts on Kerry.
I mean, I think it's all part of, you know, the combination of the way that they have been raised and pushed. And he did wrestle afterwards with a prosthetic foot, and the public never knew about the crash.
Wow.
And I think they probably knew about the crash, but not the amputation, which is a
wow.
huge athletic feat. I mean, so this tells me that this man was an incredible athlete. So,
absolutely.
I mean, to go back a little bit to, you know, we see him training to be in the Olympics. It was a huge deal when the U.S. bowed out of those Olympics, because when it comes to professional athletes, you know, it's you can only really count on getting one Olympics. You know, like the really famous ones who go to lots of Olympics, there's not many of them. So that action by, who was it? Was it Jimmy Carter at the time? Who freak was president of the United States in 1979? I think that was Carter. The decision ruined a lot of careers. It did.
Yeah.
It genuinely did. And we see that happening to Kerry. Because, like, I mean, a lot of his, you know, age, it's like, when are you at your peak athletically? You know, when a lot of things have to line up, you know, money and it's so, you know, to have that pulled out from under you, it affected a lot of people. And, you know, it was boycott. Yeah, it was Cold War stuff, boycotting the Soviet Union, et cetera, et cetera. Was that when they were invading Afghanistan? Was that the actual reason? I don't know. That might have been.
Yeah, 79. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, that was part of it. You know, and we do see him kind of listless, and he goes home because, you know, what else are you going to do? And he's immediately, you know, welcomed back into the fold. And, you know, instead of being like, well, you know, maybe you can go back to training and, you know, maybe you can have your Olympics in a couple more years, it's immediately like, hey, okay, you're going to come wrestle now, you know. And we do get a very fun sequence of, you know, the boys at their peak, the three, you know, Kevin, David, why can't I think of the third brother? Oh my God. Kerry, the three of them, they do become famous in the wrestling scene there. And they, you know, you do have some really fun wrestling sequences, and, you know, the actors really going for it. And yeah, I mean, again, like the exploration of the masculine physique. I mean, like it's, and I felt like it wasn't sexualized. I didn't feel any sort of, you know, improper gaze. It was just sort of like the realities of what these people had to do. You do start seeing, you do get hints of Kerry being in trouble, because there's the scene where they're at a party and you see that he's doing cocaine, and Kevin sort of looks askance, but, you know, lets it go. And you just get little hints throughout that he's unstable, you know, maybe never really getting over missing those Olympics, and then being pushed into wrestling. And he does really, really well, you know, but then starts to, you know, fall apart after the accident and losing his foot. And the fact that he could come back and wrestle with the prosthetic technology they had at the time, which was, you know, vastly different than what we have today, you know, and that they were able to keep it a secret, that is a massive accomplishment.
I agree. And I think,
yeah.
It's kind of weird, because in a way, and I think this is a problem that some have had with the film, if they're like major wrestling fans, is they think that basically the film, by focusing on this tragic emotional side of the story, doesn't pay enough attention to their great technical and physical and wrestling achievements.
Mm-hmm.
And I can kind of see that, actually. I can kind of see that. Mm-hmm. I don't agree with it. I think it's a great film, but I can see it.
Yeah. So,
okay, so shall we move on to poor little Mike?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Poor little Mike. He is the sensitive poetic one. And what I did want to actually quickly mention with Carrie, you know, he did kill himself on the family property.
Yes.
As it was depicted in the movie. Let's see. I just want to check. You know, he did start having issues with painkillers. He was. I mean, like it is sort of alluded to that he was getting in trouble. And yeah, and then he. He did kill himself on the ranch, and he was barely 33. So that was that's what happened there.
And then Mike, who was the musician when we first see him in 79, he's got a garage band. He's always nerdling on his guitar. He seems to have real talent. That said, I mean, like the music to this film is composed by Richard Reed Parry of Arcade Fire did the music. So the rock songs are genuinely cool rock songs. And he basically is forced into the ring. He has no aptitude for it. He doesn't have a physique for it. Mm-hmm. He basically injures his shoulder. He has surgery. It doesn't go as planned. He gets toxic shock syndrome that puts him in a coma. And then the next time we see him, he's sort of in a press conference in a sling. And it looks like he has some kind of brain damage. He's slurring his words. But he's going to be put back in the ring. Everyone's like, yeah, but look what a great fighter he is. Mm-hmm. And he just can't take it. He commits suicide. He takes tranquilizers and must also have been incredibly young. I mean, looks very young on screen, played by a guy called Stanley Simmons. He's done a few bits here and there, but nothing. This must be his breakout role, I guess. But
he was very good.
How old was he when he died? Because, I mean, he can't have been.
23.
Oh, my goodness.
And this was, you know, storytelling choices. What he actually did was he went to a nearby park and overdosed and died that way and was found later. And then what they showed in the movie was that he did the same thing, but only just walking out onto the family property a bit. And then being found by the family. Which, I mean, not totally. I feel like, you know, it's honoring the spirit versus the letter, you know, and but, you know, just having to keep everything, you know, sort of streamlined and put together. And it was actually, you know, visually beautiful, the family walking out into the fields, calling his name, and then you see one, you know, start yelling, and then everyone else starts running, and you don't have to see, you know what's happened.
Actually, all of it's very respectful, isn't it? Like the motorcycle accident. Like, it's amazing how little they... Sean Durkin's a master of this in all his films. That
it's worse when you don't...
Heartbreaking.
I was going to say, it's worse when you don't see it, because then you imagine. Yeah.
But what a kid. Apparently, and so that's basically the final death in the film, but it's worth pointing out there was another brother called Chris von Erich, who also died by suicide, age 21, from a gunshot. Apparently... He was really, like, he was short, he was asthmatic, he was in no way shape meant to be in the wrestling ring, but nonetheless, pressure puts you in there, and he wanted to be with his brothers, apparently, and I think that's what's depicted, isn't it? I think there's a beautiful scene near the end of this film where Kevin, he's in the film with the dead body of his brother, but he imagines those that have gone reuniting, so the three fully grown brothers and actually the little kid, the 6.5-year-old little kid. And it's shot so beautifully by the cinematographer Matthias Erdely. And if it doesn't get dusty in the cinema or wherever you're watching this when you see that scene, it broke me. It just broke me.
Oh yeah, no, there was not a dry eye in the house, myself included. When I saw it, definitely it grabbed everybody. That was the purpose of it.
And I feel that that's in a way the film gives you, in a sense, in these two end scenes, is that sequence. So the people who've gone, who are in this beautiful sunlit haze, and they're together, and they're brothers, and there's no dad to boss them around, and they're just happy. Yeah. And then there's the kind of the real world end scene, which is, you know, fast forward a number of years. Kevin has sold the franchise and he's got his own kids now. And they're the little baby blonde brothers. And he's crying. He's watching them play and he's just crying and crying. And because he's been raised in this toxic masculinity, he apologizes for crying. And as I said earlier, I just think it's the most heartbreakingly but also uplifting scene where the two little boys, thank God for generational change, right? They're just like, Dad, don't apologize for crying. We cry all the time. That's all right. And then the other brother says, what's making you sad? And he says, well, I guess I just miss my brothers. And the two boys say, that's okay, Dad, you can be our brother. And then they hug and you just feel that he's going to be okay, because
these kids do not have that toxic masculinity. They express their emotions and they're going to support him. And then you see the end coder and you see this picture of, you know, the wife and him and all their kids and grandkids, and it's just joyous. So yeah, I do feel that reviewers don't get it. If they think they, this is a bummer of a film, it's not. It's a, it's a film about a survivor who created a family that wasn't toxic from one that was.
Yeah, and in the end, they bought a farm and everyone came to live with them. You know, that's it. And that was, But I mean, no, definitely that last part of the film, there was sniffles aplenty in the theater. I wanted to actually go back to that really beautiful, you know, imagination dream sequence of the afterlife, because it was just, it was so beautifully done. And I started losing at the moment that, okay, so, you know, Carrie dies, and Kevin picks up his body and brings it into the house, lays him on the dining room table. You know, just a very symbolic, you know, you got the whole Christ-like imagery, you know, and the symbol of, you know, like everything happening in this family home, you know, all this, this tragedy. And then you have this vision of Carrie walking out of the house barefoot, and you realize he's whole again. He has his foot back. And I started losing that because I started losing it at that point, because that's such a beautiful thing. You know, if you believe in an afterlife, anything like that, that one of the promises is that we will be whole again physically. If you had those issues in life, you know, that you will be restored, that you will be, you know, yeah, made whole. So I started being like, oh no, this is what everyone was talking about, how it's going to make you cry. And it's just, you know, beautiful. You know, he's in a boat, you know, again, symbolism of moving into the afterlife, and the other brothers are waiting for him. And Mike has his guitar, and David is just, you know, decked out in his sort of, you know, cowboy finery, and they're themselves again. They're restored, you know, and then you turn around and you see the little brother who's, you know, eternally 6 years old, but he's there, and they all hug, and then they, you know, go off into this beautiful field. And what is the afterlife if not, you know, a beautiful grassy field in summer? That's what we all hope for, to be reunited and an eternal, beautiful summer. And I'm actually kind of upsetting myself a little bit thinking about it. But yeah, so Kevin does make it. And then we do see, you know, the dissolution of the parents, because there's a moment of, it's when Mike is still trying to recover after the complications from his surgery, you know, leave him, brain injured. And like he and the mom are sitting, and he's looking up, you know, their walls are covered in pictures and photos. And there's this painting, and she's like, hey, that's the house I grew up with. He's like, really? And he says, yeah. She says, yeah, I painted that. And it's like, I didn't know you painted. And, you know, it's a very short scene at the end in the now empty, dark house where, you know, the mom is painting and the dad comes in. He's like, what's for dinner? And she's like, I don't know, I haven't made it. And it's just like, oh, she's had enough. And in real life, the mom, they did end up separating after all this happened. So that was a really nice way of showing that.
Yeah, it's an amazingly written and acted role, isn't it? Because Maura Taney has very few scenes. She kind of has one at the beginning with the husband when he buys the flashy car. And then she has the one with Pam, Lily James, when they're mourning the son, and she's, you know, she's in front of the dress and having her moment. And then this one at the end, and it's kind of, it's testament to her and her presence. That even with that light touch, I really feel I see an arc for her, and I see fulfillment. And positive, and I kind of feel I know that woman, that kind of woman, through this very, I mean, in a way, she could have got a Best Supporting Actor nod, because to do so much with so little is really quite something.
Yeah, I mean, I know that woman. You know, I've seen shades of that around other women and mothers and wives and you know, people, you know, because I, you know, grew up in the 80s and 90s and in a semi-rural area. And so a lot of cultural tradition did still reign. And there were a lot of women around who, you know, they might've worked outside the home, but they still very much were the people taking care of the household, the kids. And, you know, I would hear, you know, as I was getting older, my mom having discussions with her other friends and how, like, well, the last son went to college today and I just stood at the sink and cried. Cause it's like, well, what do you do with yourself now? And so, yeah, they did very succinctly show that kind of an arc, but in this very, very specific, you know, setting of just repeated tragedy of that moment of her just being like, not doing it anymore. Sorry.
Yeah,
you know, it was a real good for her moment. And again, you know what I said at the beginning, that the parents weren't bad, they were just wrong. So I didn't necessarily want to see punishment. I didn't want to see comeuppance. I just wanted to see consequences. And we got that. Does that make sense?
That makes absolute sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, this is what would happen, you know. I feel like I went into this movie not sure what it was going to be like. And at first I was kind of like, I didn't know if I liked it or not, but now I have had some distance and I really appreciate it for what it was. And like, because it's an A24 movie and they've sort of established themselves through movies like The Witch and Hereditary and Midsommar as like weird stylized horror movies, I almost thought this was going to be, you know, more horror adjacent. Like the title, The Iron Claw, you know, like that is very, you know, evocative. But you know, no. And now that I have, you know, just let the movie be what it is, then, you know, it's like, yeah, this was really good. And what it was a pretty straightforward family drama and also a period piece, you know, talking about America at the end of the 20th century. And we see those changes. You know, we see women's roles changing. We see men's roles changing. But here's something interesting about the kids. Is the two brothers who are depicted, what are their names? Marshall and, they're real people, Marshall and Ross. Guess what? They're professional wrestlers now. Even after, and this is what I was talking about with these wrestling dynasties.
It's phenomenal though, because one would hope, and I think I would hope, that they're wrestlers on their own terms, like they're doing, because they see there's a brand name, there's a family legacy.
I hope so.
But one hopes it's, and I think it must be right, because we're not seeing that level of tragedy and well, maybe it's not manifesting in the same way, but I do find it phenomenal when you see everything that's happened in this film, which is just a slice of everything that really happened, that they want to take that forward. They really do, but yeah. Gosh.
Well, I mean, for me, when I first found that out, I had the opposite reaction of just like, after everything your family went through and you wanted to do this, you know, I mean, I definitely see your point for sure. It just, I just found it to be very surprising. And they're these tall blonde guys, you know, as their family produces, and they're like, I want to say in their 30s. But they're the little boys at the end of the movie there. But I mean, I would like to think that they are doing it on their own terms, and things are a lot safer. And, you know, I mean, like at one point in the movie, it's, you know, drug use is hinted at. I mean, steroids are hinted at, and you don't see which brother's injecting it. It's a very quick scene. You blink and you miss it. But, you know, like that's alluded to. And I mean, that's still a big issue in the fitness world in general and competitive sports in general. I mean, so best of luck to the next generation. Sorry, I had to do that little moment. Yeah.
Well, look, I think it's going to be okay. I really do, because I think that when you can see it in the film, you can see it in Pam and Kevin. Mm-hmm. And of course, they're going to have the same bullshit ups and downs that we all have in our lives. But I think you take the Fritz character out of that weirdness, and I think it kind of reverts to the normality of shit that doesn't matter.
No, like I said earlier, if they just let them be who they are, they're going to succeed on their own terms. Oh, and one other thing, one other kid, Carrie, who in the movie, we did not see him having a wife and child, even though he did in life. He had two kids. One of his daughters, Lacey, also became a professional wrestler, and she has since retired from it. But, you know, she did professional wrestling, and now she has a family of her own, and, you know, done. So she's out there doing her thing. You know, which is pretty amazing. That, you know, even though it killed her father, she went into it and was successful. And, you know, and it looks like now she's, you know, sort of able to live her own life. That she lives in SoCal now and apparently runs an advertising company. Good for her. Yeah. But the very end of the movie, we see, you know, Kevin made it out, and he and Pam, they bought a farm, and everyone came to live with them, which is very, very sweet. And so really just I don't even want to say it's a cautionary tale. It's just, here's what happened and here's why it happened.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But also that, you know, from that can come love, joy, good. That wedding sequence the evident love between the brothers, and the fact that this ends up with kids and grandkids who survive. I want to encourage people to watch this film. It was so little watched. So I know we've majored on the tragedy, and that is the text of the film. But it's important to recognize that it wouldn't matter if it was just dirge after dirge. It wouldn't matter. Mm-hmm. It's because we recognize that fraternal love and see the kind of almost childlike goodness in someone like a Kevin, that it matters and it affects you deeply. Anything else you want to say on this lovely film?
I mean, I wanted to talk a little bit about the land of the family farm that we see time and time again, even certain shots of like the front driveway with that one tree. And it really, you know, and it starts to become, you know, a thing that makes you tense up when they show it, because you're like, oh God, what happened now? Because the family home is the site of much tragedy. The interesting thing is the land doesn't change. The land is, it's beautiful, it's serene, and it's bearing mute witness to all of this tragedy. And it just, and it almost swallows it up at times, like when they go and, you know, they find the youngest brother's body, and, you know, and Carrie kills himself, you know, right outside the front door, basically. You know, it's a remarkable way to frame all the action in, you know, this beautiful nature. And then we see after the afterlife is, okay, we finally get to go and be in this nature, you know, on our own terms, and enjoy it and appreciate it. And it's no longer just sort of sitting there, not being utilized, if you will. So it's just, yeah, just something that really stuck out to me, because I love a good sort of, you know, natural vista shot, if you will. But I think in conclusion that now Kevin and Pam's kids know that at least one of them was conceived in the front seat of a truck.
Oh, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. Yes. I love it. Well, let's end on that note, because that is a phenomenal note on which to end. Yeah, let me know when there's another film that you absolutely love that I need to watch, because you are spot on with this one. This was absolutely a
thank
banger.
You.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's brought great emotion to my life. All right. Well, have a lovely rest of the evening. And this has been a pleasure, Julia. Maybe you can just say, what are you looking forward to? You're plugged into the right circles, and good indie films tend to come out in New York before they hit London. So anything coming up that you're excited to see? I mean, obviously Jean's coming out in a week's time. We have our tickets for that, so we're excited. But anything small scale indie that you're looking forward to?
You know, I got to think about that, because I haven't really started getting back into that mindset yet. Because, I mean, honestly, you know, it's still coming down from the holidays and all that. But I am really curious about the Joker Folie à Deux movie coming out, which I'm not sure if that's going to be small scale per se. There's the movie with Sydney Sweeney, Immaculate, which looks really interesting. I am a sucker for any kind of like Catholic religious iconography done in a beautiful way. Yes, I really love the Young Pope, New Pope series.
Did that officially ever get cancelled, or is it that still sort of out in the ether somewhere?
The Young Pope, New Pope series? I mean, like, it was just a self-contained two-season series. I mean, they kind of finished it up with, they told a story, and that was it. And that's fine. That's fine. It stands just fine on its own as a single story. So I think those are kind of the only ones I'm really aware of. I saw this trailer for the new Dev Patel movie, Monkey Man, where basically it's like he's Goku but trying to take down a criminal empire. So like, okay, all right. Well, I mean, it's, I guess there's some allusions to the classic, like some of the classic fairy tale creatures in Asian and Indian mythology, like the one monkey god. Okay, so it isn't about Dragon Ball, but like certain parts of the anime Dragon Ball are based on like the old Journey to the West and whatnot. So like I saw that and I was kind of like, oh, so they're taking that same source of inspiration but going in this other direction. But it's like an action film in that sort of a Bollywood vibe, but you know, definitely like mixed also with just like conventional Hollywood. So sort of interested in that. Dune Part 2 comes out in a couple weeks, but of course, again, that's not small. I'll tell you one that I'm not interested in is Civil War, which really? Is going to be another A24. Yeah, it's with Kirsten Dunst and her husband. What's his name?
Yeah, and also it's an Alex Garland film, so he did Ex Machina, Annihilation. I'm looking forward to that because I love Jesse Plemons. I love Kirsten Dunst. I like Alex Garland. To me, that I'm really intrigued. Yeah. And also, there's not much knowledge of what that's going to be about, right? So I'm kind of intrigued by that one. Yeah, why are you not into it? Why do you not want to see it?
I was going to say Jesse Plemons is her husband. That's right. Because I've been living this very bizarre moment in American history now that we've been doing since about 2015. And there's been that sort of background talk of like, we're going to have a second American Civil War any minute. And I just don't see where those lines would be drawn. And, you know, this was actually one of the trailers that they had in Iron Claw, and I saw it with my cousin. She cried too. We all cried. And we see the trailer for Civil War, and like part of it is in the alliance between California and Texas. And we look at each other, I'm like, that would never happen. I'm just curious to see how they make this plausibly work, because it's just, you know, it's just not like the first Civil War that we did, just like, you know, the Civil War that you guys did about 200 years before ours. You remember that one? There were very distinct lines. You know, you guys had the royalists versus the parliamentarians. We had slave state versus free state. And here it's just kind of like a general sort of like much more sort of soupy, indistinct. You know, some people think they don't like other people from this part of the country. And a lot of it is just sort of ginned up cultural stuff that if it were to sort of be, if people would sit down and talk to each other, they would find out that they have a heck of a lot more in common than they realize. And also that, you know, the people who they think are their enemies aren't, or the problems they think are the problems aren't. You know, it's like, I'm sorry, but that's just how college kids act. And that's how it's always been and how it always will be. And just ignore it because it doesn't really signify anything. You know, so why are you worried about it?
As long as they actually grow out, which infantilization of children, I'm not sure they do these days. So the films I'm looking forward to, I am looking forward to Civil War. I'm also looking forward I love Kristen Stewart. I think she's phenomenal. I think she makes really fascinating choices with her life and with her art. And she had a film has a film called Love Lies Bleeding that played Sundance.
Oh, I've heard about that. I am interested in that.
Playing Berlin right now, and it's coming to, so the BFI, they have the big London Film Festival in October that kind of plays into the whole awards season run. But they also have the world's oldest LGBTQIA festival called Flair, and that runs every March, and it's really phenomenal. And Love Lies Bleeding is playing there, so I'm really interested to see that. Mm-hmm. And there's actually also going to be a screen talk by Elliot Page, and then the screening of his new film. So I am very excited to see Love Lies Bleeding and Elliot Page and their new film. Not their new film, his new film. Am I getting that right?
What's that? I want to say I'd heard about that movie. What's that about again?
Okay, so the film is called Close to You. It was actually released in 2023, directed by Dominic Savage and starring Elliot Page. They wrote the story together and both produced it, and it's filmed using a highly sort of improvisational style. It showed at Toronto last year. So Sam, who's Elliot Page, is heading back home for a family reunion, bumps into an old friend. He is the only real person in the cast that you will have heard of. So yeah, Greenwich Entertainment acquired the US distribution rights in January 24. So it will come out. But yeah, I just think it's really fascinating that someone like Elliot Page is having to almost create their own films to give themselves a platform for the things they want to talk about. Because conventional Hollywood will find it hard to categorize Elliot Page, I think, which is sad. But anyway, I think I'm really looking forward to that screen talk. That said, Yorgos Lanthimos and Emma Stone have already filmed an entire other film other than Poor Things. So let's see what happens.
Yes, I did hear about that.
Maybe that'll do the sort of Toronto Venice run this year and we'll get that.
Yeah, and Cannes is early May, something like that?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, thank you for listening to the after show chat. Thank you for making it this far. This is what happens when people who know each other don't get to talk that often, is we have to catch up on everything.
Absolutely. All right, listen, we hope you enjoy the Iron Claw and let us know what you think. Post a comment on the YouTube channel, drop in on the Discord server, have a chat, and tell us what movies we should be checking out. Thanks, guys.
Exactly. Bye.